Well, I'll kick this thing off officially. Why did you start on YouTube?
Hey, why not? It's something to do, isn't it? No, by accident, we just sort of threw our answer to it, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, really, that is it. Accidentally started on YouTube. Not like completely accident. I didn't fall over and bang my head on the keyboard, and next thing I knew, it uploaded a video or something. But this is a very common story, I think, from people who started in the real early days. I used to just write sort of weird little comedy things and text bits on the internet in the days before your connection was fast enough, really, to actually put any video or anything like that on, even audio in the early days. Then, when video became more sort of feasible, I was part of a forum for a specific old video games journalist, and somebody spotted on eBay this thing called a Pop Station, which was a complete rip-off of a Sony PSP, like frightening rip-off, the box, everything, except it just played one incredibly bad old LCD game using slightly different technology. So I thought that was hilarious, and it was about £5, so I bought it and then just sort of showed it off and improvised a bit around it and just uploaded the video. Back in the days when you had to download a WMV file from some extremely dubious site that you'd hosted it on, and thinking like 10 or 11 people would see it or something. But somebody forwarded the link onto Beta, B3TA, which is a big sort of creative community, I suppose, here in the UK. And they had massively, still going to this day, actually, a massively successful Friday newsletter that would go out to like 70,000 people or something. And it got listed in that. And I was reading it, I was like, wow, I didn't submit that. That's surprising. And then, like, 70,000 people saw it. This was like 2005 or something when those numbers were insane, So I was like, wow. And then I realized because I didn't really think anybody would see it, I hadn't said who I was, hadn't shown my face or anything, hadn't said my website, hadn't done anything to actually say I'd made it. And the next thing, there were loads of like accounts from American teenagers uploading it to like a Google video and saying, I made this. No, you did not. So, do you know what? I'm going to find another similar thing. I'm going to do another video, show my face on my website, and found this thing on a local market of all places called the Neo Double Games, which was a fake sort of Nintendo DS. Again, did a similar video. Remember to show myself at the start, say my name. Still forgot to put my website address. Unbelievable. But it did. It went out, and I thought, well, that'll be the end of that. But that got even more views. Sort of linked to go more downloads as it was back then. Around this time, I obviously realized that you could actually host a video online and it's a lot simpler. So I went for Google Video because I always back the winner. And 15 minutes after that, of course, it closed down. Everything went to YouTube. So, right, YouTube it is. And ended up doing a third video thinking people are going to be very sick of this now. No, they still liked it. So it just sort of went on from there. That was back in about February 2006, we started the YouTube channel. I don't know why I said we, there's only me here. And yeah, it's just gone on from there, really. That sort of spiraled, and I moved out into other bits and bobs, just sort of tat in general. And here we are today, where it's basically the same thing, but slightly more high definition, the sound's slightly better, and it's, my God, what, 17 years down the line or something. Crikey.
And you haven't really had to super diversify like a lot of other creators have. You have a very a simple setup, and just what do you think the driving force is that keeps people coming back? Is it you, or is it the interest in the weird stuff that you show off?
I think there's always repeat visits is often sort of a personality thing where people get used to your voice and think, oh, I wonder what he thinks of that or whatever. But a lot of it on mine is the product is the star, so to speak. People are interested to see what it is you're bringing, which is why, like most of my views, don't actually come from subscribers. They just come from people finding things on the internet or being served it, through search or whatever, because they're interested in whatever weird items or it gets mentioned alongside another one. That it's difficult to explain. Really understand that because, of course, we're getting into the dreaded YouTube algorithm, which nobody really understands, and that wasn't a thing in the early days. I think it's always the product that's the most important thing, really, because that is what is front and center. Literally, you just see my dad's ratty old sofa and an item, and that is it. You never have to put up with my face or anything. So, apologies to people watching this video interview, but gotta do it sometimes.
I mean, you've reached that level of e-celebrity where people know your face. It's not like a mystery. So how do you feel that's affected you being, I mean, you have 1.5 million subscribers or so. You've made two films. People have seen your face. People know who you are. How do you feel that's affected you, if at all?
It doesn't affect me. The great thing is, because my face is hidden the vast majority of the time, I think still to this day, most people don't know what I look like. I mean, it's not in any way hidden, but because it's very rarely shown. For things like being stopped in the street and that, happens like once a week maximum these days. The only time it goes up is if after releasing a film, if we do an actual film, people tend to notice, and it's always people who aren't aware of the YouTube channel. Often wonder how they find the film, but like just be stopped in the street by a 50-year-old man and said, "Oh, I saw your film the other day." I'm like, "Oh, great." He said, "Oh, it's funny with the YouTube stuff and that. What, you know, what other films are you doing?" So mostly I actually do YouTube. He's like, "That was real?" And I'm like, "Yes, yeah." It's like, great, marvelous, you know, always nice.
Where do you see yourself going in the future for your YouTube channel? Do you feel you're going to stay with the same format, or do you feel it's going to evolve into something else?
I think it will stay pretty much as is. If I was to do something else, that would be like a sort of side thing. I just really like the sort of, I don't know if purity is the right word, but the simplicity, let's go for that, of the, there's a product, there's a bad background, away you go. And it's worked for sort of a number of years now. And then the other projects I try and do alongside, because this is so incredibly lo-fi. Whenever I do anything else, I've tried to make it like massively hi-fi, like literally a feature film or something, as opposed to, you know, here's another broken LCD game on a sofa that probably hasn't been cleaned properly since 1992.
How, when you decided to make your first film, it's a massive undertaking, filmmaking is. How did you put forward that effort, that decision that, yes, I am going to go through this massive pain to make a film?
The story behind this is we did a it was a branded series for a sort of sponsorship thing. I suppose technically the whole thing was kind of an ad in its way for Dell Alienware computers back in the day. It was like a multi-part sci-fi series we produced called The Proxy, and the guy who mostly wrote it and directed all of it, Riyad Barmania, he was fantastic to work with, Canadian guy, and we became sort of proper friends very quickly actually. But he was quite clearly from an actual filmmaking background because A, he obviously really knew what he was doing, but B, he brought on various members of crew in that for the sort of small job. You're like, these guys shoot actual feature films, don't they? And he's like, oh yes, yeah, ah, cool. Anyway, we did it all. It went very well. It's a good laugh. I think we won an advertising award, whatever that means. So there's a bit of perspex somewhere with the proxy written on it. I don't know who has it. And then it sort of went over in my head. It's like, I wonder if we could actually make a film. Is this a thing that could be done? And there was a party for the production company, and I saw Riyadh there. I said, Riyadh, do you think we could actually make a film? And he said, well, technically, yes, he said, but you know, where would you get the money? Even if we do something super low budget, that's still far more money than we'll ever have, you know, probably to buy a considerable margins. So I'm like, yeah, this is true. But at the time, the production company was actually being funded directly by Google to produce specific geek content. So I'm like, I wonder if we could have a word with the sort of chap running the company and see if he would want to produce like the first kind of YouTube feature film kind of thing. And they were like, yes. And we're like, how much money? And they're like, about half what you'd need. I'm going, oh, that's good. But
Yeah,
could we
that's about right.
crowdfund? Yes, exactly. Yeah. And to be fair, they weren't holding anything back. That was a big risk for them at the time, you know. So we're like, oh God, where can we scrape money from? You're never going to get investors for this sort of thing. And it's like, ah, crowdfunding's a thing. Would people actually be interested? And they were. And the film became a thing. And a frightening amount of time and work went into it, and we ended up with Ashens and the Quest for the Game Child, or just Game Child as we tend to refer to these days. Yeah, and then I'm trying to think how many years later now, because Game Child is 10 years old this year, so that's terrifying. It went down very well. We've thought, oh, we'd like to make a sequel or something. Really, we'd like to make a trilogy, but the third one is way off from the sort of looking at it at the moment. So we did the sequel many years later, Ashens and the Polybius Heist, which was more of a, It feels like more of a lot of people say it feels like more of a sort of, I'm trying to think of a good term for it. It feels higher budget. A lot of people said it's not. Like technically it was, but if you take into account inflation, it's probably slightly lower than the first one. But I think it's what you learn along the way of the ultra low budget filmmaking comes into it as well. And yeah, that's where we are at the moment. Two films, and we're hoping to get work on another one this year.
And luckily, the films that you have made are unlike other e-celebrity films, or unlike something that you would see made by folks at Channel Awesome or something. It's a proper film. The subject matter may be different than what your standard audience is used to, but when I saw it, I was like, I am surprised this came from someone that has a YouTube career. Especially when I saw Robert Llewellyn, I was like, holy crap,
Yes,
an actual celebrity. And then when I saw Larry, I was like, oh, I know Larry.
Yes. We do that thing of which is so important when you're making low budget stuff of getting talented people who you, oh my God, hang on, have I gone? What's happened? Oh, there we are. Thank you, camera. Doing that thing of getting in people you know are good and you know you can work with well, because it's something you just can't have like a diva on set when you've got no money. Because if they slow things up, they could torpedo the whole thing, you know. And we were working with Robert. He was sort of presenting one of the channels that were being funded by Google for the production company at the time. And we'd said to him, oh, do you want to be the, oh, yes, yeah, brilliant. And we sort of got friendly with him. It's why he's in the sequel as well. Yeah, it was just such a nice little extra bit of somebody people recognize, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And Warwick Davis, of course.
Yep.
Yeah, basically the same trajectory there, yeah.
Would you ever think about making like smaller, smaller indie films, like something like 15, 20 minutes, something that's not like what you do on YouTube, but just something smaller, something that's easier to produce, and just kind of make a series like that? Or do you want to just stick to the feature films and YouTube?
The problem with short films and episodic stuff in general, really, is it still costs a fortune because a lot of it is sort of stuff, startup costs, I suppose. The other thing is there's no distribution for short films, which that will in any way make you any money at the very least. There's a lot of film festivals and things, which is a pity because I bloody love short films. We made one a few years ago, a short sort of horror film, which did the rounds on the sort of festival circuit. We won quite a lot of awards. It was all really nice. Riyadh won Best Director at the British Horror Awards, which is still one of the sort of best sort of accolades we ever got, I think. But what can you do with it afterwards? It's really
It's got to go
difficult.
in a
There's just no way.
compilation.
This is it, isn't it? Yep, some sort of horror anthology or something where they're not really. And the good horror anthologies, of course, are all woven together. So if you just pick a load of random shorts that look different, people have done it, don't get me wrong, but it never quite. Yeah, I suppose the most successful, I can't think of another successful one that took that route, be something like VHS. That's been a very successful series where it's just sort of the aesthetic that carries over, and there's no other particular thread through them. You know, they'll often have like a, in fact, I think they always have like a sort of framing device, but that doesn't feed directly into the shorts or vice versa, really.
Yeah, it's something like the ABCs of Death, where there's really no
Yes.
overarching story, but each, I mean, you get 26 individual filmmakers and you have a film. It's just, will someone
Yep.
sit through the entire thing jumping every couple minutes to a different director in a different style? It's hard to sell. I've worked in the horror genre for close to 20 years now, and just the number of DVDs I have with like 5-minute features just piles up. And out of every 100, there's two that are really good. It's not just someone running around the woods with a camera.
I might have seen quite a few films like that. Yeah. Do you know, ABCs of Death is a much better example than mine, actually, because that really is things that are not only like tonally different, but aesthetically different as well. And they have just stitched 26 of them together. I think all you get from ABCs of Death, you make one, is you get the letter, basically, don't you? They say, you've got E, decide what it stands for. Egg, evil egg. Someone will be killed by an egg as they run through a forest. Yes.
One of our first films at Dread Central was Chiquilla Banana. It was just a banana that was killing people at a horror convention. And I mean, it was something because you would just go around and all the stars we knew from different movies, different horror movies, would just like give us a couple minutes of their time just to get killed by a banana. And boom, we got a film.
That's the stuff. That's the thing, isn't it? You've got to, when you've got that opportunity, you have to take it because they do not come along often.
No.
Absolutely.
I've been on a lot of independent film shoots where it's just you take what you can get. We've got an abandoned building. We'll film the entire thing in it. There's no air conditioning, so in Florida it sucks.
Oh.
So, and we
Oh,
need
God.
gore. So the crew at this one film I was in, or not in, but I was covering, it was called Inoperable with Danielle Harris. The crew had to go out and get guts. So they went to a local slaughterhouse and got a barrel of the insides of a cow. And they didn't think, like, oh, it's hot. It's Florida. We don't have refrigeration, but let's dump it all into a wheelbarrow and use parts of it. So the entire hospital where it was being shot at just reeked of dead cow the entire shoot.
Oh my
So I was like,
God. Oh.
I've got all the footage I need. I'm gonna go write my story and I'm never coming back. But just watching them pour this just it was a leg and then there were the intestines and it was just like, ah. And you use it for like two
Oh.
shots.
Did it look good though? Did it look good?
It looked real. I mean, it was really inside of a cow. It's like you
Yep.
can't tell. I mean, you're not gonna, there's not connoisseurs of gore out there. They're going, oh, I recognize that animal. That's not a human.
There's always somebody. It's
but what
always.
people will go through to make a film is incredible. And then when you get on like stuff that Netflix is filming or CBS or something, it's just everyone's pampered. Everything's nice. Everyone's got heaters if it's cold or, everything's beautiful. I'm like, this is great, but I just don't feel the same energy I do as in a small budget shoot. I don't feel these people have the real passion
Yeah.
for it. They're just kind of there like, oh yeah, I'm making my money. I'm gonna go. I don't care about this project afterwards.
That's exactly it. With the low budget stuff, everybody has to be really pushing and really believing in it, or it's just not going to happen, or it's going to happen but kind of dip in some areas. Then you have to try and correct that. Oh God, we're very fortunate that we've never really had anyone who wasn't sort of on board big time, because I think that makes such a difference. If not, you do spend a lot of time in cleanup because oh, they didn't really. Imagine if, I don't know, your wardrobe person didn't really care and everybody looked a bit crap costume wise. You're not going to fix that with CG afterwards. If you
What budget
can,
for
get a job at Disney. Yes.
but the bad thing about independent film is they don't send you tat afterwards.
Yes, that's true.
When I covered Strangers Prey at Night, a few months later after the shoot, I got this box of just it had bloody handprints all over. I was like, oh, this looks great. And then it was like it had like a dreidel in it with like the characters' faces on it, and then a couple masks and some rope and a drink mixing kit. I was like, this none of this makes sense. I don't know what to do with a dreidel and a mask and a rope. And I was like, I'm not sure if this is a bondage kit or what.
If that's the film I'm thinking of, does it have a dreidel in it?
No, it doesn't. It
No.
was shot in Tennessee and it
What?
was shot in the trailer park.
Yeah, there's no drinks mixing either.
No, there's
What is
nothing. It
oh.
doesn't make sense, but it's weird stuff
This
like that. Netflix sent me a child's viewfinder after the first season of Stranger Things premiered. It's like it's great, but I ended up sending it to the cinema snob. I was like, here, you take this. I don't want this. I don't know what to do with this stuff.
I mean, to be fair, okay, thematically, I can understand a Viewmaster, something that's very 80s, blah, 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 but I cannot understand a dreidel for Strangers Prey at Night. That's somebody in the marketing department went, oh, they make dreidels now we can have engraved. Has anybody done that yet? Oh, that'll be different. Yeah, but what's the relevance?
But oddly, people will buy it. Like, I posted a video of it just showing it off, and all of a sudden, like, my messages were full of people being like, I'll buy that. Why?
Oh.
But
Rarity,
that's
I
happens.
suppose.
That happens with most of
Oh.
the stuff that's behind me. It just ends up being sold because I just don't have a place for it.
That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah. I've got very few. The only good film thing I've got like that is a little statuette of Birdman from Birdman, obviously. And you press a button and it talks. The problem is you can't replace the batteries, and the batteries have now run out, so I need to somehow dismantle it without destroying it. But it's yeah, I really like that little thing because it's sort of unique, but also I really like Birdman, so it means something, isn't it? What is the coolest thing you've ever been sent?
The mask that did come with the Strangers Pray by Night thing was great. It was a very good mask. It was very well made. I sold it for, I think, $200. That was probably the coolest thing. It's easier to say like the worst things, like Final Destination 3. They sent me a beanie. I live in Florida. A knit beanie.
The infamously cold Florida, yes.
Or they'll send me like child themed items for R-rated horror movies. Be like, here's a sticker set. Like, I'm not gonna give this to my daughter.
What is this weird thing? It's been going on since sort of the late 80s, early 90s of sort of adult franchises, but they aim stuff at children, like things like the Rambo cartoon, the Aliens figures, all this sort of stuff like that. And you do wonder, I suppose it's just because the children have seen the advertising and they're like, oh, if we do a kiddie version, we can make money from the kids as well. I mean, it's as simple as that, I suppose, isn't it? But it
Well,
does just seem so weird that you've got a Rambo figure with articulated rocket launcher for the kids, you know. The first film's about PTSD mostly, you know. God.
Freddy, Nightmare on Elm Street series was huge in the child toy market. I had Speedy pajamas when I was a child with Freddy Krueger's face on them, and toys and everything that's themed after a child murderer.
Yes,
But it was such a
that's such
powerhouse
a good
of
example because
it was
it's
everywhere.
the least child friendly thing, and it was absolutely everywhere, wasn't it? There's
It'd be
a
like
great oh, excuse me, sorry to say, there's a
having
great
John Wayne Gacy action figures for kids with a freaking with a crawl space playset. Bury the
yeah.
bodies, kids. Hey.
Basically, he's a fictional and supernatural version of something dangerously similar, really, isn't it?
Yes.
There's a great website and sort of associated bits called Dinosaur Dracula,
Yeah.
and the
Yeah, I've read
guy
Mad
did, you
Stuff
know,
for a lot of
oh
years.
yes, the thing he did with some of the sort of Freddy Krueger stuff that was strangely pitched, and there's one of like a candy dispenser, and there's a picture of Freddy Krueger on it, sort of going in this weird pose, and it just says the Freddy nobody knows. What are you trying to like say he's romanceable or something? Oh, he's got a soft side to him, this supernatural demon child murderer. What?
He was human at
I don't
one
know who was
time
approving
too.
that. Yeah.
But I think that whole thing stopped. I can't remember when exactly romanticizing the horror genre for children stopped. I think it was probably in the mid 90s. I think it was around the time Scream came out, because horror went through that nosedive in the early 90s, and then Wes Craven brought it back to life with Scream, and I think it just stopped. I think it was just a hard stop, because all of a sudden there was no more collectibles. Were no It was just, it moved to the collectible market. It stopped being child
Yeah.
toys and went to collectibles, because they knew now we had disposable incomes, which is why all these companies prey on those of us that are 40 and up now with all
Oh,
this
yes.
garbage.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I hadn't thought of that, but it did kind of just die off overnight, didn't it? You're absolutely correct. I suppose because the horror films became a bit more, you know, I don't serious in one way, but also a bit more sort of adult and knowing. So then you haven't just got here is image we can sell to the kids in the same way, I suppose.
Yeah,
Interesting.
you can't sell Hostel to kids. Although when I went to go
Yeah.
see Hostel 2 in theaters, there was a woman that brought her 2 4 and 5 year olds into the theater and sat in the front row. It was a Florida
What?
theater, so it makes perfect sense. But it's like, do you really want to?
Oh.
Do you really want to have your kids seeing people getting chopped up and tortured for an hour?
Oh, that's really bad. I hope the kids are all right. Bloody hell, 4 and 5 watching
Yeah.
Hostel. I mean, that's oh yeah. Okay then, blimey.
It is Florida. That's all I can say. It's just we're a very different place. We are more or less secluded from the rest of the country. We don't care what happens. We just know whatever's happening. We don't want it to happen here.
Yes, I'm from Norfolk in the UK, which is similar, just not much smaller. So it's all good, yeah.
So you said you've never been to, have you never been to America, or you've never been to Florida?
I have been to America, yeah, in 1986, went to California.
Jesus.
Yes, it was a while ago now. Transformers were very popular, and He-Man, and it's about all I remember, really.
Out of your audience, when you look at your analytics, how many are Americans that are watching your stuff?
I think they're the biggest demographic now, slightly over the UK. I think it's about sort
Wow.
of 40%, something like that. Yeah. So
That's,
it's a big percentage.
I mean, a lot of the stuff that you do cover is more or less universal. There's very few things that are just like would be so foreign to us that we'd be like, oh, but we watched your the microwaved the American style burgers that you microwave
Oh,
in the thing.
yes.
So we're just looking at them like, well, I've never seen them here, and I don't think I would ever want to eat anything like that.
They vary massively in quality, but they never get too good. Yeah, if it's very much a massive convenience thing, you know, it's like, oh, I can have a burger in 20 seconds. True, it's probably going to be pretty bad, but at least I've got something, you know. But if you're from somewhere that does good burgers, which is, let's face it, most places in some way, shape, or form, it's not going to seem very burgery. It's a bit sweaty and it's a bit sort of spongy. And yeah. If you come to the UK, you've got to try one, though. It's the law.
I've been, but I've never been desperate enough for food when in the UK that I wanted to try something that goes in a microwave.
All
No
you've
matter
got to
how
do, you've
poor
got
I
to take
was, I
one
found
bite.
something, I would find something to eat that wasn't, yeah,
Yeah.
fast.
That's the thing. They're not even that cheap in the scheme of things because, you know, you could always buy ingredients and do something cheaper, I suppose. It is the convenience factor. But no, if ever you come back to the UK, you've got to try one bite. And burgers will seem so much sweeter afterwards. Proper
I'm used to flavor from what I remember the last time I was in the UK. I remember everything being very bland. Nothing against food in the UK. It's just maybe it's where I was eating, but I'm just since I'm from the South, I'm used to a lot of Mexican food, a lot of food from Puerto Rico and Colombia, and it's just, you're just used to having all the time flavor. And then when you get something that's just mildly seasoned, you're like, I can't taste anything. Maybe it's because
Yeah, but you're used to.
my taste buds have probably been burnt from so much hot sauce that I just can't. It has to have a lot of kick to it. But
Oh, you have to bring your own sauce in that case, or just go to curry houses and have a chat with the people who are waiting and ask for something quite spicy or special, because curry houses love to cook you something off menu. That's one of their favorite things, in my experience. And you can get some really interesting stuff, almost none of which I could eat because it would be far too hot for me. But it sounds like you could probably deal with it pretty well.
Yeah, I'm just it's you just get used to it. It's weird. Like when I travel and I go someplace that doesn't have Mexican food, I'm just surprised. Like when I go like to up to Canada or something, I'm like, where's all the this is just fries with gravy on it. Where's anything that tastes anything that has flavor, please?
I'm trying to think that, yeah, I was in Toronto recently and there wasn't a whole lot of Mexican stuff. Now I think about it, yeah, hadn't realized that.
You get so used to the culture that you're around. It's just so it's such a shock that you just go two states away and you're like, none of this is familiar. It's just
Yeah.
food.
That's
Surprised at how much of who we are is made by it consists of the food we eat and the culture that we're always surrounded by, that you're just like, there's way too many white people in this state.
I mean, food-wise, it is such a big thing of culture because we have to eat so often, you know, multiple times a day. So I suppose it's very easily ingrained, isn't it? And one of my favorite things when abroad is to pop into the supermarkets and see what they've got, because 50% of it is either identical or incredibly familiar. And the other 50% is just like, I genuinely don't know what this is. When you're in Hong Kong and there's like a packet of some stuff and you're like, ah, this looks very gray. I don't know what this is. You know,
Is it
endless
food?
fun. Yes, it might not be. Maybe something for cleaning monitors or something. Always sniff before you taste. Yeah.
What's some of the something that you would never want to eat again that you've had while filming your episodes? Or what is the grossest thing that you've ever had to consume, even just a
Ooh.
tiny bit of?
Oh God.
If it's the
I
royal
always
wedding
forget the
cake, I
major
can totally
ones.
understand.
Yeah, anything that's gone off is always bad. I mean, that
Yeah.
sounds obvious, but like, oh, it sticks in your mind. And there's always this specific taste of rot that it always has in there in some way, shape, or form. Something weird that always sticks in my mind was a stick of rock, which is effectively just sugar. Basically, it's a big stick of sugar that they boil together and sell at seaside resorts in the UK. But it was curry flavored, and it was absolutely disgusting. The two flavors just totally clashed with each other. And that is something I would never particularly want to try again ever for any reason. It's one of these things that's been made, I think, to be dreadful, and they've done a really good job at it. You know, novelty awfulness. I think
I was
that
surprised
one.
that you did not eat those olives that came out of the shipwreck. I waited that whole
Genuinely,
episode. I was like, oh, maybe he'll do it. Maybe he'll do it.
absolutely not. That's just an instant botulism. I mean, whatever's been fermenting in there is not going to be kind to humans whatsoever. Oh, we had this horrible, ironic thing recently. I was clearing out my dad's house after he'd died with a friend, and we found a load of bottles of like alcohol, like sort of vodka and, like there's a martini and all this kind of stuff in a bottle of wine. So he never really drank, but he somehow had these things there covered in dust, even though they'd been in the cupboard. That's how long they'd been there. We thought, right, well, we'll take them and we'll try them because surely alcohol won't really go off. Maybe the wine will be dodgy. Every single bottle had gone off in some way. And I don't know if somehow he'd heated that cupboard and ruined it, but like we were looking on Google and it's like saying, oh yes, if this dry martini isn't that old, it'll be fine. And if it is old, it'll have just got more alcoholic and blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. No. Take a tiny sip of it and it tasted of nuts. Like in not in a good way. It's not supposed to taste like that, you know. We had to end up throwing out every single bottle. It had all gone horribly awry. I do wonder now if it just got overly warm or something. But there was a horrible irony to that, in that Ashens manages to get a load of drink and all of it's gone off and is undrinkable. In hindsight, that could have been a video, but of course we didn't know any of them had gone off till we opened. Oh,
I had a bottle of absinthe that I brought over from the Czech
oh.
Republic that sat for a good 15 years, and I was like, I'm not gonna risk it. So at a New Year's Eve party, I just let my roommate and her friends just have it. I was like, just take this. I'm moving out in a couple weeks anyway, so if something happens, it's not a problem.
Don't drink it in the next 2 weeks.
I was like, just give me the bottle back. So I kept the bottle and I filled it with green resin so it looks like it's full. But yeah, it's like I took one whiff of it. I was like, this smells just like pure licorice, just black licorice. Like it punches you in the face how strong it was. Like I don't want to risk it.
Absinthe is lethal, isn't it? And the old-fashioned stuff had wormwood in, which is sort of vaguely hallucinogenic, I believe. I spoke to somebody once who had played a drinking game with absinthe, not large amounts, we hasten to add, they'd probably be dead. They did this on a Friday and they woke up on the Sunday morning. They'd just been like unconscious, basically in a bathroom for like over 24 hours. And they said that they woke up and they've never felt anything like they felt like utterly dehydrated because it was then drunk anything for 24 hours. Just like, you know, I'm like, oh, good. Yeah, I might avoid absinthe after that. That kind of put me off that story, to be honest. Oh.
One of my final questions is really for everyone that wants to start a YouTube channel now, in the way things are right now. What would be your advice to those people that think they want to kind of break into the space?
Oh, so the problem is, I'm not sure anyone has a really valid answer for this. I mean, the facetious answer is make friends with Mr. Beast and get him to like all your videos. If you can do that, good for you. But I'm not even sure that would perhaps work due to the way the algorithm runs. I think the only thing you can do is find something that you are very interested in and happy to keep producing, and hope don't go crazy, especially at the start on production values. You know, keep the idea clean, go with it, and stick at it, and see what happens. You know, that's not a guaranteed path to success by any means, but that's the base level. If you're not interested in what you're doing and it isn't something you can stick at, then people, you know, just won't either A, be interested, or just won't be shown to them. And when I say sort of stick at it, you don't have to be that consistent. It's not like every Tuesday at 4 p.m. there'll be a new video. If you can do that, it helps. But don't beat yourself up if you can't. Just get stuff out every so often, and These days, you have to keep it quite thematic similar in some way, whether visually similar or tonally similar. Whereas in the past, you could do sort of almost any crazy stuff. But again, don't beat yourself up if you want to do something different, because a lot of the YouTubers from a certain period caught themselves in very narrow corridors of content. And then if they did something outside of that, then everybody watching would be like, I don't want this. I subscribed for, X and you're giving us Y. And so they just stuck with X. And then they got very fed up of it and they got burnt out and they've all disappeared. So, I'm not saying you will be successful, but if you are going to be successful, make sure it's something you can keep being successful at without burning yourself out.